Blog Talk Radio.
But the point is that I know how to handle these crises.
We are and always will be the United States of America.
Excuse me, Fox News.
A series of tubes.
I think we look pretty good.
I'll get Osama bin Laden, my friends. I'll get him. I know how to get him.
E pluribus unum. Out of many, one.
If some of those jobs are lost in this, so be it.
Thank you, Wisconsin!
Liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans, moderates of all opinions, welcome to Civil Discourse. My name is Eric Brandt. With me, as always, is former State Senator Peter Baer. How's it going, Peter?
Going great, Eric. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Hope that everyone out there listening is doing well on this Mother's Day weekend. You can listen to us live every Saturday at 11 a.m. Just go to blogtalkradio.com. Do a search for Janesville Community Radio, click on their link, and then click on the link for Civil Discourse. There is a lot going on in the news today. We've got a jam-packed show, but on the line today, as promised, we are looking forward to this conversation, is Democratic candidate for governor of Wisconsin and former Trek executive Mary Burke. Mary, welcome to Civil Discourse.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be on.
We really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. And let's just jump right into it. There's a very good chance that you could win election in November. The polling is getting tighter and tighter. Some conservative polls are showing that it's already tied up. It's possible that we could also flip the state Senate. That could also go Democratic. The assembly is going to be a higher mountain to climb because of the gerrymandering. And so if you're elected, how do you plan to work with a divided government, especially considering that if the assembly follows the route of the House of Representatives at the federal level, they could stonewall you at every pass? How do you work with that?
Well, over my 30-year career, both at Trek Bicycle and as Secretary of Commerce for the state, I have always tried to find the common ground. And I believe that we can do that in Wisconsin. Jobs have to be the top priority. Under Governor Walker, our economy is lagging other states in the Midwest. In fact, out of 10 Midwestern states, we're ninth in job growth under Governor Walker. So I believe we can find the common ground. We have to find the common ground. And it's the tone that's set by the governor as to whether we are going to work together or whether we're going to be divisive. And my approach is certainly working together and finding that common ground. But I will not be afraid to use the tools that the governor has to encourage people to sit down at the table. And what we have to do is, you know, identify where we are now, set a vision for where we want to be, the state, the type of state we want to be. Then let's get all the options on the table as to how we can move forward and choose the best ones. I don't care if they're Democratic or Republican ideas. Let's choose the ones that are going to work and then bring people together, because that's how we know we do our best work here in Wisconsin. So that's the tone I'm going to set as governor, and that's the approach I'm going to take.
That's great. So that's going to essentially be I prefer to say leadership pulpit rather than bully pulpit, because the word bully has some negative connotations. But the leadership pulpit is going to be used by you as governor, is what you're saying. If I'm correct.
Exactly. Yeah. That's true leadership is when you bring people together, and we know that's how we do our best work. This divisiveness and pitting people against each other is not how we do our best work, and it's not how we're going to make sure that Wisconsin is a leader rather than the lagging we are doing right now in our economy under Governor Walker.
Mary, student loan debt in this country has now surpassed credit card debt and stands at over $1 trillion. As governor, what are some things that you can do that will help relieve this burden? Because, you know, case in point, someone maybe go to business school because they want to start their own business, but when they graduate, all of their money is tied up in the schooling, and which makes it much harder for them to move forward in their career. What are some things that you can do to help our anybody, not just the younger generation?
Well, it's a huge issue, and it's one that I have laid out Things That We Can Do in my Invest for Success plan that I released last month. And a few of the things are, first of all, that I suggest and will work towards is increased deductibility of school tuition and fees. I've suggested putting that up to $10,000 from where it is now, $10,000 a year, which would cover fees and tuition at all UW campuses at this point. I would also make student loan payments deductible as well, which greatly brings down the cost. The other thing we need to do is have a refinancing authority to bring down the rate on student loans. There's people who are paying 6-7% in an environment where interest rates are actually very low. So we can, without a cost, we can bring down that cost to those who have student loans. The other thing is that we need to bring down the cost of education, of higher education, because we know we actually have to have more people who are pursuing certificates or degrees, extra training after high school in order to compete for the jobs of the future. So we need to increase capacity, but we also have to bring down the costs. And that's something that at Trek Bicycle that I'm used to doing, balancing budgets, seeing how you can be as effective and efficient as possible, but making sure that we have high quality and accessibility. So this is an issue that I want to take on as governor, because education is incredibly important for Wisconsin's economy, and that means skills and training so that people can compete and Wisconsin can compete for the jobs that are going to be created in the future.
Mary, to segue from what you just said, and reminding our listeners that you were Secretary of Commerce in Wisconsin previously, do you have thoughts on any new initiatives beyond what have already been done by previous administrations and whatever little has been done by this administration, if anything, to encourage the exports of Wisconsin products? Obviously, you have experience in that area personally as a business person in terms of international trade that would benefit our state. What are your thoughts?
Oh, there's a lot more that we can be doing. And as an executive at Trek Bicycle, I actually oversaw the division that I oversaw, sold Trek Bicycles and products in Europe. I increased sales from $3 million to over $50 million. This was in the early 90s, which created more good-paying jobs right here in Wisconsin. We know we have to compete in a global economy if we want to be increasing jobs. And so I'm going to use that experience that I've had at Trek to help small and medium-sized companies sell more of their goods and services abroad. But I also will be fighting in Washington to make sure that Wisconsin manufacturers, you know, have a more level playing field with companies operating in lower-cost countries. And it is very difficult for Wisconsin manufacturers sometimes to compete with products made in other lower-cost countries because there isn't an even level playing field. And so I want to work to make sure that we are doing what we can to help Wisconsin companies be as competitive as we can.
Mary, I want to shift gears a little bit here to something that I think can help the lower to even the middle class in the state. And that is, just case in point, my wife and I did a strategic default on a house. Basically, for anyone listening, that means we foreclosed, but we planned it. We worked with an attorney, and there wasn't supposed to be any taxes or fees or anything. It was all supposed to go through. What happened was when we filed our taxes after everything completed, the federal government didn't charge us for what had happened, but the state government hit us with taxes because they looked at that debt that was forgiven as income, and we had to pay about $3,000 in taxes. I'm not trying to make this about me. I have no issue paying taxes, but this is a big concern for families who have, you know, less income, who maybe lost their job and then lost their house, and then they get hit with this unexpected tax. My accountant told me that the state could federalize because the federal government doesn't do that. Is that a road you'd be willing to go down, or what are your feelings?
Well, we should definitely look at it because this housing crisis hit a lot of people in the lower and middle classes particularly, but actually at all levels of income. And we need to look at how we can put people on a path that is going to ensure that they are able to get back on their feet and not be sort of have an anchor around them that is going to prevent them from moving forward and having a solid financial footing. So we should, I would definitely look at that. And for, in most cases, we should in Wisconsin follow the federal deductibility issues, unless there is something particular in Wisconsin that would say, no, that doesn't make sense. But I'm all for one that we have to look at how we reduce the tax burden for middle-income and low-income families because they're the ones who are being squeezed.
Yeah, Mary, a couple of quick questions here. I want to get to the AG position and how the juxtaposition of that to your role as governor should you be elected. But before we get to that, is the election itself. You know, all of us are familiar with the historical voting patterns, which is that in midterm elections, the Republican base tends to turn out in higher percentages than the Democratic base. That's just the way it is. It's not a debatable issue. There have only been very few variations from that pattern in modern history. To what extent have you focused on that issue? Obviously, if we don't get the sufficient turnout for you to be elected, all the rest of it doesn't matter. So what are your thoughts on that point?
Well, turnout is really important, and I am concerned about the roadblocks that the Republicans and Governor Walker are putting up to try to keep people away from the polls. It makes absolutely no sense at all in the recent legislation that we have seen regarding curtailing weekend voting hours, cutting back on early voting, the only having one location in municipalities at which to do that really constrains and can hurt turnout. Voting is something that is so important to our democracy. And when we see roadblocks being put up that make it harder for eligible voters to get to the poll, it makes no sense to me at all. And so we have to make sure that people have access to the polls and that they do not feel that they are being intimidated or kept away from their right to vote.
So obviously you share our pleasure with Judge Adelman's decision relative to the voter ID law. That would have certainly been a voter suppression tool. Maybe it's not over yet. They may appeal, but obviously Judge Adelman struck it down, and I'm very proud of him for that. And we would assume you share that perspective on that. But there's even a more specific aspect, Mary. I'd like to ask you. The president has made it very clear his view on raising the minimum wage. Polls nationally show that even Republicans overall favor the minimum wage being raised, certainly Democrats by huge numbers. To what extent do you think it might be that specific issue might be important in getting some of Democratic-based voters who don't customarily come out for midterms to do so? How much specific focus do you think, if any, should be on that issue, not only on the merits, but for turnout-related factors as well?
Well, I am very supportive of increasing the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. And before endorsing this, I talked to small business owners. I talked to large business owners. I talked to people to get their perspective. And everyone I talked to endorses this. It makes common sense. Someone at $7.25 an hour is not able to support themselves and their families without government assistance. I want to make sure that people who are working hard and are able to support themselves and don't have to rely on government assistance in order to do that. And so this is just, it makes common sense also because it puts money back into our economy. People who are making that wage generally have to spend all of that in order to support themselves. So this is money that gets spent, gets put back in our economy, and that's why I support it.
Mary, thank you very much. And we're actually pushing up against the clock here. We're just about out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. Is there anything you would like to add? Anything you'd like to tell our listeners?
just that I'm very confident. I'm encouraged by all the people that I talk to. I've been to every corner of the state. I've put nearly 30,000 miles on my Ford Escape, and I'm running for governor because I want to be a governor that works for the people of Wisconsin. And that's why I'm running, and I look forward to doing that.
Thank you. And what is your website?
BurkeForWisconsin.com.
And people can go there to volunteer, to donate, to get involved?
Yes, absolutely. I need their help in doing this. And please get on the website, sign up, and I welcome your support.
Thank you so much. Have a great weekend, and I hope you have a good Mother's Day.
Thanks, Eric and Peter. I appreciate it. You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so that went great. I was very impressed with some of her answers.
I agree with, I was impressed with all of her answers, but one thing that struck me besides the substantive merit of her positions is the fact that she was very well prepared to provide those answers immediately as the questions were asked. Clearly, she is someone not stumbling like Rick Perry. Let's see, what were those three agencies again? We don't have that problem here. Thank goodness.
I've said it before, and I will say it again, that getting close, not quite a year ago, probably 9 months ago or so, the first interview that I saw with Ms. Burke, she was rusty. She had been out of the public light for a while, and I was really blown away with how quickly she polished her talking points and her interviewing skills. Thought that she did a really good job. And I think that it also speaks volumes. Janesville Community Radio is small, and this is, truth be told, I have not reached out to Scott Walker to come on our show, frankly, because I don't think that he'll do it. But I would be more than happy to have him come on. But we did reach out to Mary Burke, and she came on. They got back to us that same day and set it up, and she held true to her promise, and we really appreciate it.
Let the word go forth. I think Ms. Burke is the presumptive nominee of the Democratic Party. I'm not exactly going out on a limb saying that. But let the word go forth, as former late President Kennedy said, that to Governor Walker, that if he wishes to be interviewed by Eric Brandt and Peter Baer, we are at the ready, sir.
Standing invitation.
At the ready, sir.
Oh, man, I bet you my phone's going to ring any second here. Back to topics at hand here. We just finished our conversation with Mary Burke, and if anyone out there listening would like to call and make any comments, 323-580-5769. We're actually going to take a minute here. We're going to go to our break just a little bit early, and then we're going to come back and we're going to talk about what is going on in Wisconsin this week. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
Have you heard about the chocolate available that tastes good and provides natural energy through B12 supplements? Are you looking for a motivation to lose weight or improve your health? Contact Chocolates for Life for free samples of a new cutting-edge supplement that tastes good and is good for you. More information is available at www.chocolates4life.com.
And we are back. You're listening to Civil Discourse on Janesville Community Radio. We're live every Saturday at 11 a.m. Central Standard Time. You can listen to us by going to blogtalkradio.com. Do a search for Janesville Community Radio and click on the Janesville Community Radio link and then click on the Civil Discourse link. And if you have any questions or if you'd just like to weigh in on a conversation, the phone lines are open, 323-580-5769. And there's a lot going on in Wisconsin this week. There has been a political judicial volley going on with the John Doe 2 investigation. On Tuesday, a ruling came down from Judge Randa halting the secret investigation into Walker's 2012 recall campaign. And he not only said they had to stop the investigation, but he also ordered that they had to destroy any and all evidence.
Eric, I'm 61 years old. I'm a third generation attorney. I can't say that it's never happened, but I have never heard of a federal judge ordering the destruction of evidence by prosecutors. It's breathtaking.
Ordering it returned, I can understand, obviously, but to say get
destroy
rid of it.
Destroy evidence? Prosecutors? That is literally, it's breathtaking. I'm not even going to try and say anything more.
It immediately was, that decision was immediately stayed by the 7th District Court, the Circuit Court of Appeals, and they threw it back down to Judge Randa and said, if you rule the appeal frivolous, then we will, you know, we'll allow your ruling to go forward. So again, now that was Wednesday. Then on Thursday, Judge Randa went through, ruled the appeal frivolous. But there is a little note in there that the appeals court did say that he does not have the authority to tell anyone to destroy evidence. So that part is not happening. But as it stands right now, the John Doe has been stopped. And there's more information coming out that one of the people defending Scott Walker's campaign is married to one of the assistants to Judge Randa. And
that is a conflict of interest on its face. A serious conflict of interest. And then when you take that blatant conflict of interest and combine it with a federal judge saying to prosecutors, destroy evidence, something stinks to high heaven, for lack of more sophisticated language.
Yeah, there's definitely something going on here. And speaking just layman's terms, I mean, the fact that Walker is fighting this so hard and that the Republican establishment is pushing so hard on this tells you on its face to anybody that there's something that they don't want coming out. If they truly knew that they did nothing wrong, they would let this run its course, they would be exonerated, and then they'd use it against the Democrats.
The reason we have appeals courts as, it's obvious, it's, high school civics or whatever, but just to take a quick view of it, the reason we have courts of appeals is because it is understood that at the circuit court level, a district court level, judges make mistakes. So that's why we have courts of appeals. That's pretty much it, folks, on why we have courts of appeals or even a Supreme Court, for that matter, in case the Court of Appeals gets it wrong. But it is exceptionally noteworthy, in my view, that the Seventh Circuit, which is widely regarded as a prestigious circuit, all U.S. circuits are pretty high level courts. It's the next step is the Supreme Court. And that the fact that they said that Randa does not have the authority to order the destruction of evidence tells you that a higher level of judicial wisdom, knowledge, and authority has said that Judge Randa, or essentially what they're saying is, translated into plain language, illegally ordered the destruction of evidence. Why? I have a three-letter question. Why? Why? Why destroy the evidence? What are they afraid of? Why does a judge break the law and order evidence to be destroyed? I'm upset about this, in case my tone of voice isn't revealing it.
Well, there's a lot of, buzz around the internet and in the media right now that if this is allowed to stand, it's basically going to knock down any coordination between campaigns and super PACs and whatnot, which right now, if it's an advocacy PAC and they're not supporting Scott Walker, they're saying, hey, we support this issue, blah, blah, blah. There's a very thin line there that appears to have been crossed, and we're assuming that it has, which is we're assuming again based on this John Doe investigation, but the rules are still there, and if this is allowed to stand, it's really going to blur that, and it's one more step towards, I'll say it, fascism. We're seeing corporations and the government getting together, collaborating against the middle class, and that's what's happening. It's government by money,
and you that's true in the matter that we just talked about. I agree with you. And of course, that clearly is a situation where if that investigation had been allowed to go forward, if that evidence, which is now not going to be destroyed, through some further judicial procedure come to see the light of day, there is a possibility that issue alone, if it's a close election, and there's profound questions of legal conduct on the part of the governor, that surely could make the difference of whether he is defeated or not. To think for a moment that is unrelated to any of the things going on in the judicial side in this strains logic and strains it badly. But let me segue that to another issue where we also have the same sort of thing going on, and that is mining. As our listeners know, we've talked about it a few times on this program, and people just following the news know that there's been a lot of controversy, but particularly in northern Wisconsin in the vicinity of the Pinoki Range, which is in northern Wisconsin, very close to Lake Superior, just south of Lake Superior, where Gojibite Mining Company wants to do taconite mining. We've talked before about how they brought in Blackwater type, paramilitary type people, heavily armed, to make sure that no protester could survive a trespass onto their premises, and that sort of thing. And the Koch brothers, who've now gotten so infamous that they need no further introduction, actually had were prepared and did, in fact, go to the level of not just the national, not a state-level race, not a congressional race, not a state legislative race, not even a county executive race or judicial race, but county board in one of the smallest counties in Wisconsin, a county of less than 10,000 people. There are more people in Middleton. There are more people in Wanakee. There are more people in Sun Prairie than there are in Iron County, in each of those three, not all three, each. Okay? The Koch brothers came in, poured a bunch of money into a county board race up there, which was only a few weeks ago, and managed to flip. They lost a couple of the races they entered. I'm tickled to report, but not all that tickled, because they won just enough seats. They won by one enough to flip the board to make sure that anything that the mining companies want to do up there can go forward. And regardless of the environmental implications of that and the potential long-term, if not permanent, despoilment of what is one of the most beautiful natural areas in our country, in the world, which is our pristine northern Wisconsin, Lake Superior shoreline, and the land just to the south. And, one wonders, I remember, back in the day, there was a popular perception throughout Wisconsin, generally, maybe not so much here in Dane County, but in general, that the DNR would exceed its authority, or the DNR had too much authority, that sort of thing. And I was hoping we would have time to ask Mary Burke about this, but we were grateful for the time that we did get to have her on our program, and didn't get a chance to ask her about this. But I really wonder whether our next governor, suppose that Mary Burke is elected governor, will she give more authority to the DNR, simply appoint a head of the DNR who has actually some environmental sensitivity, contrary to the current situation, or would she even go so far as possibly seeking some guidance, help, or otherwise collaboration with the Environmental Protection Agency? Because these are some very serious issues in our state that are going to affect a lot of people, and are going to affect our state long beyond our lifetimes.
I agree. And, just from the pollution aspect to the tribal thing and all of that, I completely agree that this whole mining thing shouldn't have gone through. And I, for many reasons, hope that we replace Scott Walker, but I hope we replace him with someone who's going to do something about it. I'm just seeing this online right now. This is at sfgate.com, which I've never been to, but the AFL-CIO shared this. Talking about the John Doe investigation, it said, what will happen next? And it says, prosecutors could ask for another stay while the appeal to Randa's order is pending. The appeals court has also set a schedule to receive briefs from attorneys in the appeal with the last deadline on July 30th. While the federal case is ongoing, there are also three other lawsuits pending in state court connected to the investigation. The special prosecutor leading the investigation, Francis Schmitz, has asked an appeals court to reverse a judge's decision in one lawsuit to quash subpoenas in the case. A second lawsuit involves two unnamed parties asking the Wisconsin Supreme Court to challenge the investigation, and three other unnamed parties argue that Peterson lacks authority to run such a probe. So everything that happened this week looks like it's just the tip of one iceberg, and there's a lot of other things floating around out there, which goes back to what I said before, that Scott Walker and the RNC are fighting like crazy to stop this from going forward.
Yeah, what, exactly.
That to me implies guilt on some level.
You think? I'm not going to call you paranoid on that, Eric, because it's so obvious. Look at this pattern. First of all, they're asking for they actually got a federal judge to unlawfully order the destruction of prosecutorial evidence.
And I have not heard anyone who can justify that.
I've not heard of anyone who's ever suggested it in any litigation in the United States. And again, I'm sure I've probably missed something, and it's been happened somewhere sometime in the past. But I can guarantee you, that as someone who works in the profession now, that it is extraordinarily uncommon, if not unheard of. Secondly, then that's followed quickly on the heels of that, followed by quashing subpoenas. What's the common?
Actually, I think that happened first. That happened a while back.
Okay, well, even so, then on that assumption, it's still a common thread. The thread is suppression of evidence. Quashing a subpoena. What does that mean? A subpoena is a document that compels a person or an entity to appear in a court of law relative to some litigation. It may be criminal or maybe civil, but some litigation that is ongoing, and it is a judicial command to appear, that is, to provide information. Sometimes documents may be subpoenaed, sometimes individual people may be subpoenaed to testify, but the purpose of a subpoena is to get more information, not less. The purpose of prosecutorial evidence is that this one judge wanted destroyed unlawfully, according to his superiors at the Seventh Circuit, unlawfully destroy evidence. I don't even know how a judge can look himself in the mirror with that kind of a ruling. But in any case, it's the same pattern, though. Suppression of testimony. And then what do we have? We also have a law passed, signed into law by the governor, to repress voters from voting, suppress voters, have fewer voters rather than more. Whatever happened to the old saying, sunshine is the best disinfectant? It seems that Scott Walker is the poster child for whatever is the opposite of the theorem, sunshine is the best disinfectant. That would be the darkness is the best protection against the consequences of disinfection.
That's why they call it dark money. I think this really ties into what we talked about last week about judicial review and how important judges and the judicial branch are and how powerful they are. For everyone listening, anyone who does not vote in your spring elections when judges are on the ballot, you have got to start. We have, as people on the left or even in the center, you've got to start voting for judges. This is absolutely crucial. Now, yes, you know, some of what we're talking about here has to do with judges who were appointed, but still, a lot of these things can happen on the lower level. That's where they originate. So it is so crucial that we start understanding how powerful the judicial branch of our government is. It's almost getting to monarchy standards for the Supreme Court.
It is. And one of the particularly cruel twists of this whole thing in my view, is that the Citizens United decision and the other decisions that have opened the floodgates for undisclosed donor money, third-party money, outside group money, which if this particular federal judge we were talking about a few minutes ago had his way, there wouldn't perhaps have to be any separation between the candidacies.
He doesn't want any. He's a real big Citizens United McCutcheon backer. He wants money.
Yeah, to the point of ordering unlawfully ordering the destruction of evidence. Really a shocking thing. I think that, you know, such an assertion for a law school student might have caused the professorial staff to review whether that person should still be in law school. But in any event, the fact of this suppression pattern that's been going on is just kind of terrifying. And it's telling that the old picture's worth a thousand words, is that this pattern of Governor Walker's and his supporters is less information, fewer people to vote, fewer hours to vote, suppression of evidence, quashing of subpoenas. It's all in the negative. Nothing goes towards an airing of more facts, more information, more awareness of the public, more transparency in government. All the steps that at least are publicly made known of this administration and its supporters are precisely in the opposite direction of transparency.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. In response to the ruling, I think this was actually in response to the Tuesday ruling, which is the one that kicked all of this off. Walker said that he hopes we can just move on.
If I were he, that's what I would wish too.
He said, this is the first of what will hopefully be close to the finishing touches of that investigation being completed. And that would be good, not so much for me, but the people of the state. He did stop short of proclaiming victory with the latest ruling. Asked if his campaign felt vindicated, he said, I don't claim that one way or another. I'll leave that up to other observers. So this is not...
Let's move on. Just put the evidence in the shredding machine.
Well, just like the whole recall thing, the union thing, the abortion thing, the voter. Let's just move on. That's in the past. But he keeps putting these things in the future.
Get the evidence into the shredder. Let's just do that first before someone sees it.
Which kind of leads to a question here. I mean, this, you know, whether Walker wins or not on this, in my opinion, this has not been good publicity. You can't see the forest from the trees. Well, you've got to stop for a second, though, because, Peter, we're political junkies. We've both been following the thick of this. Someone who doesn't really pay attention, what are they seeing? A headline that this was stopped. Oh, it's back on. Now it's been stopped. Well, he who laughs last laughs the loudest. And in the end, they're seeing that this thing has been stopped. So that might tell people, low information voters, that Walker is vindicated.
Sure.
But you don't know that. And a lot of people are paying attention to this. And it also, you know, it leads to a question here of when is the last time Scott Walker had a good week? This guy, I can't believe he's still polling in the upper 40s. Because
every week that he continues to be governor of Wisconsin is a good week for him.
But he, not in the media. I mean, you know what I'm saying.
You understand what I'm saying.
He's got bad jobs numbers. He's getting things knocked down in court because he's passing unconstitutional laws. He's got this criminal probe surrounding him. He's got polling that is showing that he's either tied with a newcomer or else just leading by a few points. And yet somehow he is still staying at, you know, 47-48%. Now, I've got a clip here that I want everyone to hear. This came out, I saw it hit the internet yesterday. There's some people questioning its legitimacy. I'm not asserting anything, but this sure sounds like Scott Walker to me. And supposedly, this is from his audiobook, which was just released this week. And I want you to listen to this clip.
Sector union. 10. You take a week off to protest in Wisconsin and your office runs better. 9. On a snow day when they say non-essential people should stay home, you know who they mean. 8. You get paid twice as much as a private sector person doing the same job, make up the difference by doing half as much work. 7. It takes longer to fire you than an average killer spends on death row. 6, the worse you do your job, the more your boss avoids you. 5, you think the French are working themselves to death. 4, you know by having a copy of the Holy Quran on your desk, your job is 100% safe. 3, you spend more time at protest marches than at church. 2, you have a Democratic congressman's lips permanently attached to your butt. 1, you pay more in union dues than you do for your health care insurance.
So that is what Scott Walker thinks about public service employees.
Is that his top 10 list or something?
That is the joke that came out in the 26,000 pages of emails that when they were going through all those things, he read that off to all of the people in his office. And now apparently he put it in his book and then recorded himself saying it in his audio book. That sounds like all that the Democrats need to do is run that to start getting more union support.
I don't think there's much dispute about where union support is going to be going in the November election. But that goes back to my earlier question to Mary Burke and the question I've also asked others of our guests, such as Senators Cullen and Erpenbach. Is what is going to be done about that turnout? And I'm hoping that the reason I'm not getting any straight answers to that question from anybody, even though I agree with the people with whom I agree on most issues, is what is going to be done differently this time than 2010 to get that vote out? I ask the question, and the answer always comes back, oh, yes. Minimum wage, it must be raised and so forth. You know, Mary Burke said it. Senator Erpenbach said it. Senator Cullen said it. Representative Hasselbein said it. But I haven't heard anybody say that any special measures would be taken in this election to leverage, to not just take a position on the issue. Yeah, we understand that. Thank you. Good position. What's going to be done to get those people who would be affected by that policy out to the polls to vote? Because people who would be affected directly by that policy tend to be the very people we need at the polls on November, on the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, and don't usually show up in large numbers in midterms. What is going to be done about that? I'm hoping the reason that no one's giving me an answer is because there is some grand strategy and they just don't want to reveal it right now. Because my concern is that the absence of a strategy is a prescription for defeat.
And that's such a hard mountain to climb, short of putting a referendum on the ballot to increase the minimum wage, which in this state is non-binding, but it does put the voters on record for supporting or not supporting something. The Republicans used it in 2010 because they knew that the support for the train was low. I think Dane County and possibly Milwaukee are the only ones that it passed. Everywhere else, everyone voted it down. Now we know that we've lost thousands and thousands of jobs over that, and not to mention that it's a springboard into the future of transportation. So the Republicans get it, and they put these issues on the ballot. Hopefully the Democrats have something up their sleeve. I don't know, short of putting a referendum on the ballot, what it would be. I don't know.
I have a couple of ideas, one in particular, which is that you develop a grassroots protocol explicitly targeting those voters, those potential voters, and really target them. What was it that the Obama campaign did in 2012 to get the kinds of numbers out and have people standing, even in places that had Republican control of the election machinery, therefore not enough ballots in Democratic precincts, so people who were 98 or 103 years old had to stand in line for 10 hours. But they did it, Eric. They did it. What needs to happen is somehow to replicate that kind of passion that caused people to stand in line as long as they had to and show up and do it, without President Obama's name or potential President Hillary Clinton's name on the ballot. We've got to get our brethren and sistren who are of modest means, and who it's hard to take time off from work to even go vote and that sort of thing. But it's in their direct economic best interest. And if we fail to get that message efficiently delivered to those specific people, we lose.
And that comes down to you and me and everyone who's listening to this show right now, to be talking to people and making sure that people understand, because I think that most people simply don't get it. It's not, they might not, you know, be voting out of malice. They're voting because Republicans live off of bumper stickers. You know, I saw a sticker the other day that said, "Hope is not a strategy." Well, you're right. It's not. It's a bumper sticker. It's a campaign slogan. That's all it was ever meant to be. But they can't tell the difference. We can. That's what sets us apart. So get out there and make sure that you're telling people. Well, but we have to go to a break real quick. We will be right back. Stay with us.
Check out the new business center that has opened in downtown Janesville. My office, JVL, provides full business services for home-based companies or the professional that only needs an occasional meeting space in the Rock County area. Professional, fully staffed, and convenient, My Office JVL can provide you with everything from a virtual office address to an on-site copy center, office space, and a full-sized conference room. www.myoffice-jvl.com.
And we are back. You're listening to Civil Discourse on Janesville Community Radio. We're live every Saturday at 11 a.m. Just go to blogtalkradio.com, do a search for Janesville Community Radio, click on their link, and then click on the link for Civil Discourse, and we will come straight to your computer, and you can listen to us live. You can also listen to us on the same website, archived. As soon as this show is over, it will be posted as a podcast. And then tomorrow we'll get it up on TuneIn, Stitcher, and Podomatic.com. You can listen to those. You can go to civildiscourse.podomatic.com and also on iTunes. Peter, let's change gears here, because something else came out here that I really want to talk about. A new poll came out by CNBC showing that even millionaires think that the rich should be paying higher taxes. It's showing that American millionaires do have complicated views, yet they also believe that they're unashamed of their own wealth and attribute their success to hard work and smart investing. They still seem to be holding on to that belief that anyone can do it. And the fact of the matter is that America is actually now one of, if not the least socially fluid countries in the world. If you're born poor, you're going to die poor. If you're born rich, you're going to stay rich. And
well, the Supreme Court decisions like Citizens United and voting rights tend to calcify that very tragic status, where we, just a few decades ago, we led the world, or we were certainly among the leaders in the world for a period of time. We were surely the world leader after World War II in the growth of the middle class, the upward mobility of people of American citizenship or American even residency. And that has gone backwards so far since the Clinton administration years, but it even that the trend had started even before that. But Clinton's presidency tended to stabilize that problem for a while, because things were generally pretty good economically through across the spectrum during those years of his presidency. But otherwise, there's been a pretty much continuous trend since the latter half of the last previous century into the present moment, and it's becoming even more extreme in the present moment. That this calcified situation where you, as you said, you're born rich, you die rich; you're born poor, you stay poor. And so forth. And the mobility, where the U.S. stands among industrialized nations and even some non-industrialized nations on the social mobility scale, we're dropping. We're not even in the top handful of countries anymore. And that is a real tragedy in terms of what the American dream and the American ethic has been all about since the beginning of this the founding of this nation.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You talk about how, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, we were the most fluid. And you're right. And what were we doing at that point? We were living under the New Deal. We had a big emphasis on education. It was more affordable. We did add higher taxes on millionaires. And I don't even know if we had billionaires back then.
Few. I think Sam Walton was one of the first.
We had much better pay for everyday jobs. Productivity and wages were tied. Reagan severed that tie. We had a much higher rate of unionization. More people were making better money. There was just more jobs. Free trade. China wasn't taking advantage of us at that point. A lot of those things all factored in. And now it's like Elizabeth Warren said, that the system is rigged. And, you know, a couple of days ago, I went out to lunch with a friend of mine. He's a staunch conservative, thought that George Bush was too liberal, just to give you an idea. But he's a good guy. He's reasonable in the sense that you can talk without shouting at each other. And he asked me, and he said, is this what you guys want? Are things going the way that you want? And I didn't quite know what he meant. And he said, well, you've got a lot of people on welfare. You've got high unemployment. Is this what you guys want? And I said, no, this isn't what we want. Yeah, there's a Democrat in the White House, but you have Republicans in Congress, and they have the power of the purse under the Constitution. You've got a 5-4 majority on the Supreme Court, which is more powerful than either of the other two branches. And the more that I thought about it, keep going there. And, you know, I explained to him that, no, we don't want people on welfare, but we acknowledge that it has to be there. We acknowledge there's a need for it. And he says, well, they keep extending unemployment. It used to be 26 weeks. And he says, if people start starving, they're going to get a job. And it's like, no, they're not. We've got 3 people applying for every job that pays under $15 an hour, 7 people applying for every job over $15 an hour. And most of these people, if you just force them to get a job, what are they going to end up getting a job doing? They're going to work at Walmart, McDonald's, Hardee's, Burger King, and they're going to end up on welfare anyway because these billion-dollar corporations won't pay them enough to live. And the more that I thought about it, the more, and this was after the conversation, and I'm glad I didn't think about it during the conversation because we did have a good, honest talk exchange of ideas, but I could have changed that and turned it around on him completely and said, is this what you guys want? You guys, we're seeing taxes as low as they've been in 50 or 60 years. Inequality is as high as it was in 1929 and increasing. We've got more and more consolidation. 6 or 7 companies control up to 70% of every industry in this country. You think about it. You want to go out to eat? What are your choices? Perkins, Ponderosa, Hardee's, McDonald's. You want to go buy a car, Ford, Chevy, Chrysler. You want to get a cell phone, AT&T, Verizon. Everything has been monopolized, even if there isn't it's not a true monopoly as in one company, but we're still seeing the effects of a monopoly. Case in point with cell phones. If AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile get together and written, unwritten, spoken, unspoken, decide, you know what? None of us are going to offer a plan under $75 a month. Guess what? You don't have anywhere else to go. I had even talked to an executive at one of the telecommunications companies at one point, and I asked him what was going to be the effect of the whole Verizon thing with the NSA. And his answer was, well, number one, when the government says we want this, you turn it over. That's the way it is. But number two, where are you going to go? Where are you going to go? That's the economy that has happened. That's how it's rigged. We've allowed this to get out of control. It's like if the Packers are playing the Bears, but the Bears had enough money to pay off the refs, and they said, you know what? First off, our 50-yard line is going to be at our 20-yard line, so we've only got to push 20 yards to score. Number two, our touchdowns are going to be 8 points. All the Packers' touchdowns are going to be 3 points. Number three, our field goals, we just got to get it into the end zone. They still got to go through the goalpost. Oh, and on top of all of that, we are starting off not 0-0. We're going to accumulate all of the points that we already made this year. That's how the economy is running at this point. And when you're coming out of school and you're trying to get going, if you're not already born rich, you're the Packers in that football game.
I agree. And I think, if your conversation with your colleague had been extended a little further and you'd gotten a little closer to some of the things that you just said, I predict that it would have been a very short and easy answer for him to give you if you would turn the question around on him. Is he happy with the way things are? The answer would have to be, if it were an honest answer, a simple 3-letter answer. Yes, they are happy with the way things are because they have made things this way, and this is what they want.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'll go back to the one issue that's going to determine whether things will become so calcified that there's really no light at the end of the tunnel on this very profound degradation of the essence of our democracy. That will be the turnout in 2014. If it's like 2010, it's only going to get worse, Eric. And if it's not, if it's more like 1998, when even though it was Clinton's second term and it was a midterm election, people were offended by the fact they may not have, not many people approved of Clinton's private personal behavior, but polls showed that 70% of Americans thought that impeachment was entirely inappropriate and not constitutionally proper or otherwise proper in that situation. And in fact, I know an attorney who was a big-time attorney, argues in front of the Supreme Court and stuff like that, U.S. Supremes. And he's a Republican. He never voted for a Democrat. But he's a constitutional lawyer. He was so upset at the impeachment. He told me, and I had a conversation with him after the election in 98, which was surprisingly pro-Democrat, considering that it was a midterm. It's the one exception to the rule in modern recent times. So hopefully somehow for under different conditions, hopefully we get there. But the this attorney told me that he voted for every Democrat. He'd never voted Democrat before. He voted for every Democrat on the ballot from the top to dog catcher or whatever was the lowest thing on the ballot in his jurisdiction in Long Island. He said because as a constitutional attorney, even though he's a dyed-in-the-wool red Republican, he said he is also a constitutional scholar. And he said this is constitutionally an abomination to bring President of the United States to impeachment for under these particular circumstances.
Yeah, we're almost out of time. Big thank you to Mary Burke.
Absolutely.
For coming on the show today.
Thank you, and best wishes for success as well.
Yes.
Speaking for myself and I think for both of us.
Yeah, absolutely. Really appreciate you coming on the show today, Mrs. Burke, and good luck. Thank you to everyone who's listening. Again, we are live every Saturday at 11 on blogtalkradio.com. Just go to blogtalkradio.com, do a search for Janesville Community Radio, click on their link, and then click on the link for Civil Discourse. I want to give a thank you out to 350 Madison, the Economowoc Dems, the Rock County Progressives, the Rock County Dems, and the Middleton Action Team. If any of you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can email us at civildiscourse2011@hotmail.com. Check us out on Facebook. Give us a like, Civil Discourse. Look us up on Twitter, @CDiscourse. A lot of good news information coming out of there. And be sure to subscribe on iTunes for free. Give us a 5-star rating. And please tell your friends to listen to Civil Discourse. That's going to do it for this week. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you, Eric.